So we're going to look at some texts as we usually do and discuss those a little bit. And then after laying that out, a little bit different than what we've been doing, I'm going to lay some points out about the Bible and alcohol in general. Because I think it's an appropriate time to do that, because there's some very, very clear and distinct things said in Proverbs about it. So let's start here with Proverbs 20 and verse 1, which is this big declaration right here. Proverbs 20 and verse 1. Tristan, can you read that for us, please?
Wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise.
Okay. I think that second statement is one that you want to lay over everything that we're going to look at today. First of all, I want you to parse this out with me. First of all, the expression strong drink. What's talked about here? This is where I'm going to provide some things for you that we typically haven't been doing in this class. Strong drink is a reference in this time and age for either wine that's mixed with herbs, which would give the drink a little kick. We're used to synthetic chemical compounds that have an effect on the body, like the medicines that we take. In ancient times, they were involved in all kinds of, experimenting with herbs and things such as that. It could be a reference to wine not mixed with water, more on that in a moment, or maybe wine and strong drink meaning some kind of fermented drink from grain, which is like a beer. So wines and beers existed in biblical times, so it could be a beer. Well, according to this text here, what does wine do?
It mocks you.
It what?
It's a mocker.
It's a mocker. Okay? What does that mean? Wine mocks the drinker. You don't drink it, then you mock somebody else. It's wine mocks you. Wine is a mocker, strong drink, a brawler. So, yes?
Well, it loosens your inhibitions, and you end up looking foolish.
Okay. Somehow or another, it gets the best of you. It makes you look bad or foolish, or less than what you really want to be. And what does strong drink do?
Intoxicates.
Yeah, what does it do?
Intoxicates. Brawler.
Makes you a brawler. Okay.
Just an illustration of this. I remember years ago, one of my general contractors had a Christmas party, and Anita and I went, and he got intoxicated. And he was bragging about how many sit-ups he could do and things like that, and he just looked so foolish.
Right.
And it was embarrassing.
Right. Yeah. And another time you've seen, he wasn't like that.
No.
Yeah. So it takes you and it turns you into something that you're not. It mocks you and it makes you a brawler. The idea of brawler there means what? I think most translations have brawler here.
Wow.
You're contentious, fighting. We just studied about strife and anger and the danger of strife and the damage that strife does. Well, you want to have more strife with more people? Drink. You have more conflicts with other human beings if you drink. It's interesting how, we're going to do this a little bit later on, you can take all kinds of non-biblical data and lay it right with this, and it makes the same point. Okay, but let's keep going here. what this is saying here, whoever is led astray is not wise. Alcohol, this is some of the foundation right here, alcohol is counter to wisdom. As a substance, it impedes wisdom. It interferes with wise behavior. It robs you of wisdom. It lowers your discretion, your discernment, your understanding. The thing that we talked about, that some of the characteristics of wisdom, being able to see the consequences of something, see down the path a little bit, alcohol distorts that. That's why it's interesting. It's interesting, the history of alcohol, by the way. And I would be really reluctant to recommend this book, but to Christians. And people who have a biblical understanding of alcohol, and I want to lay this out for you today. There's a book called The History of the World in Six Glasses. It's a, anybody ever read it? Fascinating book. So six kinds of beverages sum up the history of the world. It's a fantastic book. Beer, wine, distilled spirits, tea, coffee, and Coca-Cola. It's a great book. It's a really insightful book if you really want to understand some things about alcohol. Now, obviously, it's written from the perspective of not someone trying to say you shouldn't drink alcohol. It's not. But when you look at a lot of the facts that he talks about, it's very interesting. Very interesting from a perspective of a Christian. But I would recommend that somebody who does not have a biblical view of some things, because it can be taken as an endorsement or something. But it really lines up really nicely with some things the Bible says about alcohol. It really does. So anyway, the point here before we move on is what it does to you. And everything that we've been studying so far about the value of wisdom and the importance of wisdom and how you've got to work and have wisdom, you got to seek it. Alcohol is an impediment to wisdom. It's an obstacle to wisdom. And I would even dare say that if you ask the average person in the world, does alcohol make you wiser or more foolish? If they were honest, they would say, well, easily I'm more of a fool when I drink. Which is one of the points of that book, is when coffee came along, get off on this a little bit. When coffee came along, people started going to coffee houses. And what does coffee do? Well, wine and alcohol is a depressant. It slows your mind down. They would go to these coffee houses, and their minds were sparking. And there were these things that came out of it, like the Enlightenment and revolutions and inventions, because their minds were stimulated rather than being depressed. So it's, you know, you just got to look at the facts. Instead of what I want to do, what are the facts? And the facts are plain. What alcohol does. So we can leave it at that, but there's more here. So let's look at more of what the Bible says about it in the book of Proverbs. First of all, wine is referenced in a positive fashion in the book. We've looked at these. Look at 3, 9, and 10. Daryl, will you read that, please? And then Ray Coney's here in just a moment, chapter 9, verse 5. But let's talk about 3, 9, and 10, first of all.
Honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all your produce. So your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine.
All right, thank you. What translation do you have? New American?
Yeah.
Okay. Yours says new wine, New American. English Standard says wine. Others, I'm not sure what it says there. Well, here, wine is a symbol of what?
Blessing.
Blessing, prosperity, abundance. We talked about this. Understand, though, when the Bible uses the term wine, it's a different kind of term, or either the application of the term is a little different in some ways, many ways different than the way we use the word wine. For instance, in the Bible, both in Old and New Testament, there is not a word for new wine, which is unfermented grape juice, and wine that is fermented that has an alcohol content. Wine is just wine. It's just the extract from the juice. The common New Testament term is oinos. It's just an extraction from a juice from the grape, fermented or unfermented. So you've got to look at the context to see if it's talking about fermented or unfermented. Okay? And I would say this also to you, that any kind of alcoholic beverage, wine or later on distilled spirits, which is centuries later, it was used for more purposes than just a drinking beverage. So if you look down your aisle at Walmart or a grocery store and you see all these cleaning agents, before industrial companies developed a way to make those cleaning agents, one of the things that people used as a stringent, as a stripper, as a sanitizer, as a cleaner, was alcohol. So producing alcoholic beverages, wine or distilled spirits, usually not so much beer, people would use those for a variety of things, as well as if you go down the aisle at the store and see all the over-the-counter medicines, Same thing. Alcohol is used for medicinal purposes. So understand that the term wine, we like look at it in modern terms as something very specific. Oh, it's that bottle of red or white wine that you have with dinner. Okay? Or people say they have to have it at the end of the workday. Oh, I gotta get home and get my glass of wine, or I can't cope. That's not necessarily the substance we're talking about in the Bible. It can be grape juice. Or it can be this liquid that's produced for this purpose or that purpose or whatever, not necessarily the cook because you got a difficult boss. 9:5, right?
Come eat of my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed.
Right, this is wisdom talking, and wisdom is making the invitation. Come eat the food and come drink the wine, okay, that I have mixed. Now, what does mixed wine mean? It can mean different things. We're going to talk in a moment what this is about. This is using wine in a positive way. That wisdom is saying, I've prepared a feast for you to partake of, including mixed wine. More on that mixed wine in just a second. Now, just as there are these positive references to wine, understanding the context, and as we'll do later on, understanding more what wine is in biblical times, there are these dire warnings about it, which indicates an alcoholic beverage, because grape juice wouldn't do this. Okay? Very vivid warning. 23:29-35. Gary, can you read that for us? 23:29-35.
Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaint? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who tarry long over wine. Those who go to try mixed wine. Do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things, and your heart utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink.
All right, thank you. According to this text here, and the wine that's being depicted there, they understood it in this day and age, what's being talked about. It's an alcoholic wine, okay? How does it appear to the drinker?
Inviting.
Inviting, attractive, okay? Good. What does it do?
Brings like a serpent.
Yeah. Brings ruin.
I said bites like a serpent.
Bites like a serpent. I mean, it is a poisonous thing. Okay? That's the idea.
But you see strange things.
You see things. But yet there's a quality about it. And this is where this last section shows that this is just an extra danger. The person who really desires this, and then they get bitten by this serpent and they get poisoned by it. When the experience is over, what's their disposition?
They want to go back.
They want to go back. They want another drink. There's that addictive quality. See that? This is destroying the person, but they keep wanting more and more and more of it. And that is depicting something incredibly powerful and dangerous. You know,
as somebody who's worked in construction for 40 years, I can go on with example after example after example of people who have ruined their own lives and others because of alcohol. You know, and we all know people, but it seemed to be so rampant in the construction.
I mean, I think there are certain socioeconomic classes that are beer classes, wine classes, and liquor classes. No matter what economic bracket you're in, there's some poison that people pick. You know, people say that, pick your poison, you know. What's your poison? Well, it's true. It is poison. By the way, literally, it is poison. You know that, right? I mean, if those of you who know more about chemistry than I do know that alcohol is actually a byproduct, that's actually a waste product that's supposed to be disposed of when this substance turns, okay? It's like urine It's a byproduct. Chemically, it's what it is. So, anyway, look at this one. 31:4-7. 31:4-7. Hilton, can you read that for us, please? 31. This is toward the latter part of the book. This is actually getting out of the Proverbs of Solomon, by the way. 31:4-7, please.
It is not for king of a mule, it is not for kings to drink wine, for the prince intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law, and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. And give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember the miseries no more.
All right, thank you. Remember Hebrew parallelism. That's how you understand these statements, that they're complementing one another, either the opposite or they're building on one another. So, who should not get wine?
The king, those in authority.
The king, somebody in authority. Why? What are they having to do?
To remember the law, the decrees.
That's right. Make laws, lead people, make important decisions. Do we ever have to make important decisions, even though we're not kings? Do we ever have to make judgments about things and use understanding? Okay? This is going to distort the king. And think about it. Who's in the best position to have wine? It's going to be a king. And so, a king should not be drinking wine. In this context, it's alcoholic wine, it's not juice. Because it affects his mental function. Who was recommended to get one?
Those who have trouble in the world. Trouble in life.
And specifically, what does it say at the beginning of verse 6?
They're what? Someone dying.
They're dying. They're perishing. The one who is perishing and those in bitter distress. This sort of sounds like a medicinal application. Like you would use morphine, doesn't it? So, you know, we can get into the ethics of all that and things like that, but I don't think we want to. But understand, okay, yeah, wine is endorsed by Proverbs. Yeah, for perishing. So you want to get in that kind of situation? So, I mean, see the difference there, but when you're having to use judgment, and the king is just representative here of someone who has a lot of heavy responsibility in judgments, but we understand when you put it with the others that we've seen, that wine distorts your judgment, which is why the idea that, you know, has become, you know, people talk about America going down the tubes and so forth, and in many ways, yes, big time. Morally, big time. It's interesting. In other ways, it's gone back, because in earlier times, there was no regulation of alcohol. None. So, I mean, it was not until the early 20th century that you began to see some regulation of alcohol, but they started regulating it, went way extreme, and went to prohibition. And since prohibition, there have been, to some extent, every state and municipality has had alcohol limitation laws. When you can sell it, where you can sell it, to whom you can sell it, all those kinds of things. Then, when you started to have all this, you know, fatalities and driving associated with alcohol, a lot of these strict rules about drinking and driving. And so our society recognizes the danger of that. Well, have you ever looked at how much alcohol is considered drunk driving? It's not that much. It's not that much. It's basically a couple of drinks. It's a couple of drinks, either a couple of cocktails or a couple of previous sized beers or glasses of wine, and you are legally drunk, most people. Why? You think they got that number arbitrarily? No, scientists figured that as a very small amount of alcohol, your eyes, your brain, your hand coordination is distorted. And actually, the scientific data shows that with the ingestion of the first just drink or so of alcohol, your body starts getting affected by it. And so it's a very low threshold before your body and your mind is affected in its function with alcohol. And no wonder you see these statements in here in Proverbs, which is way ahead of the game a little bit. So, okay, now let me lay out some material for you, and then in light of what we've just done here. People ask, you know, is it a sin to drink even out of alcohol? Fair question. Drinking is so pervasive. While there are more strict rules about drinking in our society, it is not about the pervasiveness of it. It is pervasive. It's everywhere. In some ways, more than it was in the earlier 20th century, but still a lot of prohibitions upon it. It's very easy to be affected by this and pulled into it. And so the question is, can you drink alcohol in some kind of moderation? Well, let me lay out several points for you. First of all, that's based on the assumption that each reference in the Bible about wine is talking about alcoholic wine. People say, see, there's wine talked about here and wine talked about there in the Bible. Okay, is that alcoholic wine? We've seen some references that are talking about seeing things and being bitten like a serpent. This is definitely talking about alcoholic wine. But just because your vats are overflowing with wine doesn't necessarily mean it's alcoholic. Because, by the way, when you first put the wine in the vat, it's not alcoholic. It's coming right out from the field, okay? So it just depends upon the context. So it's also based upon the assumption that ancient alcoholic wines are the same as modern wines. Are you sitting there thinking, are you saying they're different? Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. I don't know. I'm not going to turn to this because of time. I'm going to throw this text up there. I'm going to reference it. I think all of us are familiar. This is the number one text used for people who say the Bible endorses the use of alcohol, and that is Jesus turning water to wine. John 2 tells us about Jesus at a wedding feast. His mom's there. They run out of wine. The mom props him. There were 6 water pots there. You got to remember how big the water pots were, by the way.
30 gallons.
20 to 30 gallons each. 20 to 30 gallons each. So that's just split the difference. Let's say 6 times 25. How many gallons is that? 150. Of course. Just, I wish every Bible class I taught I had Frank Gregory. Where have you been all my life? 150 gallons of wine. Is that a lot of wine? That's a lot of wine. Now, when the person tastes the wine in this text, you tell me, you know the text. But let's just flip over there, just to make sure you understand this. In John 2, verse 9, when the master of the feast tasted the water, now becomes Jesus turns the water into wine. He has them fill the 6 water pots full of water, and they dip it out in his wine. When the water now became wine and did not know where it came from, the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first. And when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you kept the good wine until now. Now, English Standard says people drunk freely. What does your translation say? Drink freely.
Mine says when the guests have well drunk.
Well drunk.
Have a footnote that says, or have become drunk.
Or have become drunk. You know what the term drunk means? Filled up. I'm full by eating. I'm well full of wine. So these people are full of wine, and Jesus makes them 150 gallons of more alcoholic wine? I'm just asking. If you take that this means that this is wine like people drink today, and they are, where the text tells us where they're at, they're filled with this wine. If you take the position that this is wine like people drink today, alcoholic wine, then Jesus takes them after they pass the point of moderation. And he gives them another 150 gallons. And they're like, well, how many people are there? Maybe there are 5,000 people there. Probably not right, given the size of Nazareth, and it's actually a kingdom rather. So you got to watch there, because instead of this endorsing Jesus as one who supports the moderate use of wine, if you think that this is alcoholic wine, it really endorses Jesus as a pusher of wine that's alcoholic even when you're filled with it. Okay, so that's drunkenness. Yes?
A couple of times I've taken my crew to the Brazilian steakhouse for Christmas over here, and it's a really neat place. And they come around with these big old things of meat and serve you. But I've noticed that they serve you the good cuts in the very beginning. And then when they come back around later, they aren't bringing those good cuts unless you ask for it, because they don't want all that
wasted.
Yeah.
Same thing. So I'm just saying here, just look at this text. If somebody's going to use it as an endorsement, be careful. Because we really don't know in this context what kind of wine this is. I would say to you, I'm inclined to think it's not one with a high alcoholic content or one at all. Okay? So, this helps to explain that. And that's the idea of wine in biblical times being mixed with water. Years ago, actually decades ago, I actually ran across some material about this, and some people shared it with me. Some of it written by Everett Ferguson, who is a New Testament scholar, New Testament historian, who is a New Testament Christian. And it's easy to sort of dismiss this, like, yeah, this is a guy who's a Christian trying to, you know, fight alcohol, and he's going to come up with these things. I was just curious this week. I think it was Thursday, and I just thought, okay, let's just do a check on this. Water mixed with wine in ancient times. Oh, you wouldn't believe the websites that came up, including this one, called Wine Cabinet. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a church. This is not a preacher's website. This is a wine connoisseur website. This is a website for people into wine, okay? And I found another one just like it, okay? Called Vino Something's on our website. And this article on the website is about ancient wines. So I want you to read it. I'm not going to read it, I want you to read that. So this very pro-wine person, his first assertion regarding a comparison between modern wines and wines of ancient times is what?
Very little similarity.
There's not a lot. First of all, it was common to do wine in ancient times.
Cut it with wine.
Almost every ancient society did this that we have record of. And here he's quoting Greeks and Romans here, who cut it as many as 20 parts to one, or 8 to one, or at least 3 to one. Oh, I would love to see this. Someone's got a big old goblet of wine and go, oh, hang on, let me put 3 parts of water into this. It would ruin it for the person in modern times. It makes it a completely different beverage. As Ferguson said, I don't have Ferguson up here, but Ferguson wrote this decades ago. He said it probably would have affected your kidneys and your bladder before it affected your ability and your brain and so forth, because it was so diluted when you got rid of the alcohol. And why did people put water in wine back then? What does it say?
Well, the wine wouldn't last otherwise.
It would stretch it out, but he talks about drinking like even fresh grape juice, it didn't last very long, and the water is oftentimes contaminated. In many cases, it was to purify the water. Okay?
Paul's instructed to Timothy.
Yeah. Right. In verse 75. But also, according to the last paragraph, how did even the ancient pagan see drinking unmixed wine?
Scandalous.
What'd you say?
Scandalous.
Scandalous. And we know the Romans and the Greeks had such high moral standards. I said facetiously. The Romans and the Greeks never met a sin they didn't like. And they're like, well, this stuff's too powerful. You better cut it in water. Okay.
Yes, you know, you crowd control, all that stuff. They didn't want their people getting out of hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So, let me throw some other things out here to you also. Sugar content of modern grapes are much higher. Why? We have experimented with seeds and hybrids. When it comes to anything, farmers now can grow stuff. They get more yield from an acre of grain or corn or whatever. Agriculture has never been as productive as it is in modern times. It's been that way for about 150 years. Has to do with all kinds of chemistries and fertilizers and equipment and all this kind of stuff. And the kind of soil. The kind of soil that you have. When you think of wines being grown today, you think of wines grown in Western Europe like France. You think of wines grown in America like on the West Coast. Although they grow wine around here too. I know that. But the soils are so much more productive. So the sugar content in grapes are much higher today. Which means, when the grape juice ferments, you have more what? Alcohol, because you have more sugar. That's where the alcohol is derived from the sugar. Okay? And did you know that distilled spirits, like whiskey and gin and things such as that, they didn't exist in biblical times. They're discovered in the Middle Ages. How they discovered it is actually, in a way, quite sort of sad, and but it's also funny, okay, how they discovered what taking a grain will do and you distill it and so forth, and I'll tell you that if you want to talk about that later. But it's not until the Middle Ages that they have, like, whiskey and things like that. They didn't have it in biblical times. The Romans and Greeks didn't have that. But they had other things. They would take beers and wines, and they would put stuff in it to fortify, you know, the herbs and so forth, like doctoring it with pills today. But that kind of alcoholic beverage didn't exist in biblical times. So, I mean, and it's even, as you know, even more potent. You know, that much beer has about as much alcohol as that much whiskey. So it's even more potent kind of thing. So, and then you just look at, or it's made a couple of references to this, I mean, the societal problems and the control. How many times something happens and then somebody has said, like, well, they were drinking. And even the average person, like, oh, you know. Like somebody gets into a scrap with their mate, or somebody wrecks a car, or somebody does something crazy at work. Like, oh, they've been drinking. People are like, oh, really? They understand now why. And they're like, oh. People know what it does to them. And so here's the point. This is a substance that inherently impairs you. At what drop does it do it? Depends on how much weight you have on your body. Depends on your own DNA and chemical makeup. But bottom line, this is a subject that inherently impairs your judgment and works counter to everything we've been learning in the Proverbs about pursuing wisdom. So, the wisdom that's imparted by all these facts, scientific facts, historical facts, but more important, the foundation of all this, the wisdom that God is imparting in this revelation of the Proverbs, the wisdom is that alcoholic beverages should be used. And a Christian who's trying to be a righteous, holy person under control and using good judgment in every situation and trying to have a positive influence and a good example and to know how to handle things, and you studied about, you know, words fitly spoken and all that. This, you just have to take what you're trying to be and do as a Christian and throw it out the window if you want to use alcohol. Because it completely works against all that. So at what point is it sinful and drunkenness is sin and all that? I just think that those are moot points in a way. Because everything about alcohol runs counter to what you're trying to be as a Christian. I think that's why this is a good time to look at this topic toward the end of what we've been doing, because we've seen the importance of wisdom all along. Okay, thanks for letting me lay those points out there, those facts. All right, comments. Got a couple minutes.
We read a proverb this week. It actually had to do with adultery, but it says, can a man take fire into his bosom and not be burned?
Yeah.
And I think that applies to alcohol, because you're just setting yourself up for problems. The one thing the Bible tells us over and over again is to be in control of our emotions and our actions and our thoughts and things such as that. And what does alcohol do? It inhibits all of
that. You know, we've learned this, and it all just dovetails with what the scriptures reveal. Some people have a physical propensity to alcoholism. And you're an alcoholic the first drink they take. We understand that. If you've looked at any of this, and roughly it's 1 in 6. 1 in 6, think about that. That's like chambers in a gun.
Compare that to the COVID, though.
Yeah. So it's like roulette. It's like Russian roulette. You know what Russian roulette is, right? You put one round in a chamber, spin it, pull the trigger. So when somebody takes their first drink, it's 1 in 6, they're going to be an alcoholic immediately. So this is just a really, really scary thing. And so I do want to add this, and that is references to unmixed wine and references in the Bible to lingering long at the wine, which is found over in that Proverbs 29 passage, verse 29, 35. Talks about lingering at the wine. Those make more sense when you understand that commonly wine was drank diluted with water. So you're really drinking a lot to get that effect, okay? More than people would tolerate today. You got to drink, 2 bottles of this wine to really fill it. Most people wouldn't want that. I wanted a couple of glasses the most. So you had to really linger at the wine heavily, long, to get the effect. Okay? But if you cut it with a lot of water, you hardly get that effect. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, Kristen.
It probably goes without saying, a pretty obvious point, but all these negatives that come from from alcohol in Proverbs 23, today there are probably thousands of substances that can tackle those similar issues that are a lot easier to get. That kind of thing is more dangerous because of the prevalence of that today.
Thank you for throwing that out. We can go there, but it would be very applicable to narcotics and drug use.
Absolutely.
Which they didn't have back then.
Let me put you on the spot, but what was behind Jesus being accused of being a wine bibber?
Wine bibber is the idea that the glutton and a wine bibber, the idea that he would go into these feasts. The Pharisees and scribes who were leveling that charge were aesthetics. They believed that you needed to deny the body. They fasted on a regular basis. So the idea that Jesus went around and had big meals with people, that's really what they're saying. You're going around having big meals with people and feasting. That doesn't show true holiness. True holiness is denying your body food and things like that. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're spiritual. Okay? So that's great. That's a great question, by the way.
But they have been ascribing guilt by association. So when seeing Jesus at the party, they're assuming he's doing these things.
So that could be that element too.
And he shouldn't be enjoying himself.
That's part of it too. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.